rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Bratfold, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, January 22nd, 2020. We have six cases on the calendar today. Four are set for oral argument, and two are on our non-oral calendar. First case we have is A19-0865, Paul Stepness versus Beth Troutman et al. And counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes for your initial oral arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Before we begin, however, I do want to note for the record that we received last-minute filings last night. One is on a motion. One is a citation to supplemental authority, citing three cases. These are not recent cases, either from the Court of Appeals or from the Supreme Court, correct?
Correct.
So these are supplemental authority that has been cited, including a case from 1928. Counsel for respondent, under the rules, you would have an opportunity to respond promptly to that notice that had been sent to us last night. And then a second is a motion to strike. Respondent, I don't know if respondent, if you've seen either one of these yet.
Your Honors, this morning I looked at both the letter and the motion to strike. I did not read the motion to strike.
Okay.
I did look at some of the cases that were cited in the letter.
Okay, thank you. And for the motion to strike under our rules of appellate practice, you would have the opportunity to respond within the timeline set under the rules. And with respect to the letter, you would have the opportunity to file a response to that as well. And I think the rules mention a prompt response is what it is on that. So I just wanted to know that for the record. With that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed with your opening arguments. You will, if you could, please state your name for the record and the party you're representing before you begin.
May it please the court, Presiding Judge Reyes, Your Honors, Bratfold and Bryan, Mr. Voss. My name is Lisa Lodine Peralta. I represent the appellant, Paul Stepness, who was the plaintiff in the underlying matter. What we have going on today is an issue of fairness, and it really underlies all of the legal issues that come today. And that is in large part related to Mr. Stepness as a pro se plaintiff below, both in the conciliation court matter that he filed and in the appeal or removal to the district court, which was done by the defendants. This fairness involves, number one, having to litigate the summary judgment motion in the district court with no, and this was on an affirmative defense, with no answer brought in by defendants raising that, and with no amendment of the pleadings or motion to amend the pleadings.
Also, are you talking about the standing argument?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Isn't standing an issue that parties can raise at any point, and even a court can raise at any point?
Standing is, and this gets to my letter citing supplemental authority today. This is not a standing issue. This is not a subject matter issue.
Well, subject matter is different than standing.
They're related, but however, defendants or respondents in their brief referred to it as well as over-encompassing subject matter jurisdiction. So that's why I throw that in and said there was no waiver because there was no subject matter jurisdiction.
But you cannot waive standing, though. You would agree with that,
correct? And they went further to say, nor subject matter jurisdiction, based on the rule. So this is a very critical part, which is why I alerted the court to the supplemental authority. On page 19 of my brief, I did point out that in this case, it's about capacity to sue. And I then cited general rules that this issue hasn't been waived and that waiver applies in this case, and the quote-unquote standing issue has been waived and should be disregarded by this court.
Counsel, but standing can't be waived, though.
Standing. But the authority that I cited to the court today, I felt was necessary because this is not standing. Capacity to sue is different than standing. And I cited the cases from this court and the Supreme Court, which is why it's a 1928 case. But the cases from this court, which are Finnegg and Crawford, what they do is they explain that there's a difference between subject matter jurisdiction, standing and capacity to sue. Three different concepts. And the courts go further and say capacity to sue is waivable. So your court is right that standing can't be waived and can be raised at different times. That is not the issue in this case. And the cases go further to suggest even if the parties and the lower court improperly use the term standing, that's a misnomer. In fact, the courts say standing is one of the most amorphous, terms or concepts in public law. That's in one of the cases I cited. So you have to be very careful to analyze this and see that it's a capacity to sue case. So,
counsel, give me your clearest explanation for why this is a capacity to sue issue.
Absolutely. I'd be very happy to do that. So capacity to sue relates to the right to maintain an action, okay? Mm-hmm. And here, respondents have said the bankruptcy trustee has the right to maintain this action. We claim otherwise under the analysis of capacity to sue. But that's the issue is who has it. So if you go and you look to the district court's language, the district court at page 8, which is A32, repeatedly cites cases on capacity to sue. Leffler says the right to pursue causes of action belonging to the debtor entering bankruptcy vests in the trustee. That's about who has the capacity to sue on this claim. The court also cited Tyler. After discharge, the bankruptcy trustee retains exclusive authority to pursue the unscheduled claims. Respondents as well have argued that the plaintiff is the person who lacks the standing to bring his claims, and that this is really,
I guess what I'm not understanding, counsel, I do understand, I appreciate your point, your fine point, which is that there are overlaps between capacity to sue and standing, or it's amorphous, however you want to describe it, but if it is true that Mr. Stepness did not have the right to maintain this action against the defendant, I am unclear on how he could have standing. How was he aggrieved? How was he harmed?
Okay, so
how can we overlook that? It would ultimately be a standing issue.
Absolutely, you can overlook it, and I'll tell you why. It is the respondents who brought the motion for summary judgment. It is the respondents who need to satisfy the elements. So if the plaintiff presents genuine issues of material fact or if the facts are actually not, the relevant facts are not disputed and are in favor of the non-moving party, in this case, Mr. Stepniss, then summary judgment was erroneous. In fact, we go further and say it was, that issue is out the window. And so if the court looks at that, that is why you have the ability to get to the issue, is that there are genuine issues of material fact about capacity to sue. And how that arises is Mr. Stepniss has a claim, has a right to a claim, if there was no property interest in this commission on February 2nd when he filed his bankruptcy petition. If he had no property interest in the commission on that date, the bankruptcy estate under bankruptcy law has no interest. And so that's where I'm claiming the facts are relevant here. And you really have, so there's at most a dispute, you know.
But isn't the dispute based on his testimony, on his averments that he is entitled to the commission because of the 8 months of work that he did?
All right. So sometimes when parties plead facts, not all of the facts end up supporting the entirety of a claim. So I'll agree with you that while he alleged in his statement of claim 8 months of work marketing, that does not have to be, that's a pleading, does not have to be held to him.
Why not? I mean, this is where I really struggle with this, because on the one hand, he sought in conciliation court $15,000 for commissions that he earned. He alleged that he spent 8 months of work, and he alleged, in fact, that he found the buyer for the property. So on the one hand, his whole claim is based on work that he did that he's entitled to. On the other hand, here, with respect to bankruptcy, you seem to be arguing against yourself by saying, oh, no, we didn't do anything beforehand, and we didn't find the buyer. In fact, that's a disputed issue, even though that is what we alleged. So I'm struggling with how can you have your cake and eat it too here?
Absolutely, and I'll explain that. Nowhere is there evidence that part of that, all of that 8 months was before the filing of the petition.
In 7 months of it were, correct? Roughly?
Yes.
And 1 month after.
But here's the problem. Those 7 months did not create any property interest in the commission on the sale. And so if you look, it is Minnesota state law which determines whether the debtor had a property interest on February 2nd, and therefore whether that goes over to the bankruptcy estate that day on the filing of the bankruptcy petition. This is where the district court made the fatal error. The district court just assumed that the 8 months alleged, which included pre-petition work, was legally relevant. It was not. And the reason why, and how this case is distinguished from the district court's law and the respondent's law, is that on February 2nd, plaintiff appellant Mr. Stepniss had no interest, property interest, in the commission.
Would he have a property interest if he found the purchaser?
Only if, under Minnesota law, it met the standard, a buyer ready, willing, and able, or a sales contract. And it's, if you look to the federal law.
Okay, let me stop you there. Okay. So you said a buyer ready, willing, and able. Didn't he allege that he did, that he actually found the buyer?
Okay, so you want to look to all of the evidence, review it most favorably to Mr. Stepniss. The house was not even listed on February 2nd, and that is...
Even if it's not listed, that doesn't mean you can't find a buyer. If it had been listed before, why couldn't you have found a buyer for the listing that,
that
existed?
That's looking at the evidence most favorably to the defendants.
So maybe I can jump in and ask it the other way. What evidence is there after the bankruptcy petition was filed that's in the record that shows there was any work at all done? I know that there's a statement or a conclusion that there was work done post-bankruptcy petition, but what is the evidence or the allegation that you're pointing to show that there was any work at all done after February, what, 2nd?
Yes. So, again, you have to look at the evidence most favorably to the plaintiff here.
So what is the evidence that you're pointing to after February 2nd?
And you have to review the pleadings liberally because he's a pro se plaintiff. He says 8 months of work. Even the district court made a finding that some of his work was post-petition.
My question is, what was the work?
He held open houses and did work. I mean, that's basically what he was doing between when it was listed on February 8th and when the buyers agreed to buy.
Okay, so maybe you can point me to the pleadings or the affidavit or something that says on a certain date that's after February 2nd, he held an open house.
I will look for that while I am
For any work at all. I don't mean to pinpoint the open house. I'm just trying to find some allegation that has a date next to it that is tied to some work that he was doing.
Absolutely. I will look for that and try to get you the answer to that while I am waiting for reply or rebuttal, excuse me. So I actually think this waiver argument is the key issue here, the most important issue, because if there's waiver, then it disposes of the affirmative defense in its entirety and turns around plaintiff's position in the case, requiring remand and reopening the decision. And that's regardless of the district court's decision on the accord matter, because that was plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. And if he didn't meet the elements in light of reviewing it most favorably to the non-moving respondents, then it just requires denial of a summary judgment motion and not throwing out the case in its entirety. I see that my time is up. I will come back on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And on rebuttal also, we ran out of time here, but on rebuttal, if you could address Minnesota Statute Section 82.85, I'd appreciate that as well. And I'm going to be asking your opposing counsel about that.
Okay.
Counsel for responding, you have 15 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Dan, last name Voss, V as in Victor, OSS, appearing on behalf of the respondents. Also present is Beth Troutman. Last night, I was served with a letter. This morning, I read the letter, and in particular, I went and looked at the Cochran case. In the letter, appellant seems to conflate these issues of standing and capacity to sue. The issue is standing. The Scott case, which is directly on point, which is the case that the district court relied on, holds that if you are a debtor in bankruptcy and you have a cause of action, that cause of action belongs to the bankruptcy trustee. Only the bankruptcy trustee has standing in the bankruptcy court to make that claim.
That claim would be made as an adversary proceeding. That's the holding of the Scott case. That's the case that the district court relied on. Now, I want to discuss next this Cochran case, which was cited in the letter. In that case, the Court of Appeals states, quote, appellants frame their argument in terms of standing and subject matter jurisdiction. We believe, however, that neither theory is applicable to the case at hand. Rather, we conclude that the issue we must address is more properly analyzed in terms of capacity to sue. A brief discussion of the differences among these concepts may aid our resolution of the question raised by this case. Now, what was at issue in this case was a foreign limited partnership and whether they had registered to do business in the state of Minnesota. So their capacity to sue was at issue. This is what the Court of Appeals had to say with regard to capacity to sue. In contrast to subject matter jurisdiction, which concerns the court's ability to consider a question, and standing, which concerns a party's right to bring a particular action, capacity to sue concerns a party's right to maintain any action. The bankruptcy trustee, according to the Scott Court and the bankruptcy case law, tells us that only the trustee has the right, in terms of the Cochran case, the right to bring that particular action. And what you have to look at is it rooted in the pre-bankruptcy past? Mr. Stepniss was not making a legal claim for a commission. He was making an equitable claim. He could not make a legal claim for a commission because Minnesota law says if you're a licensed salesperson, you have to have a writing. The record has a writing. What does the record say? It says both Beth Troutman gets 0% commission, Paul Stepniss gets 0% commission.
You're talking about the listing agreement, right?
Well, it's not even a listing agreement, Your Honor. What it is, Bridge Realty has a unique business model.
Well, whatever you call the document. So
right,
you,
right. I'm
you,
sorry. I just don't want to call it a listing because it really isn't a listing
you've
agreement.
You've raised the statute, 82.85.
That
right?
is the statute, 82.85.
So it's your position that we don't really need to look at that statute because there was a written document that expressed the party's agreement on the commission? I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I'm trying to understand
and
your
frankly,
argument.
We never got that far at the district court. What I related to the court below was that he made an equitable claim. So when he made an equitable claim, you look to the case law that says you can't make an equitable claim under Minnesota law. You just can't because of the statute. So we never got into the issue of whether this was a listing agreement or not a listing agreement or a writing. I don't know that it's signed. I don't have it here in front of me.
Well, and the reason why I asked that question about Minnesota statute section 82.85 is because the parties did argue it below. The district court did not decide that issue, but the parties did argue it, and it seems that your argument right now seems to go to the heart of that.
It does.
So in terms of that argument, I mean, that certainly could be an alternative ground that we could address this issue as well.
Absolutely, Your Honors. And I think it would be a valid ground.
And why do you think it's a valid ground? Do you think the statute applies or not then? Is
I
there
do
a writing
think it
here?
Applies. Yes, I'm sorry. Okay. If I confused anyone, I apologize.
Because it sounds like you're saying it didn't apply.
No, it does apply. Okay. What I'm suggesting is I don't know how you characterize that document. In the 32 years of practice in law, I've never seen a document like that. I wouldn't call it a listing agreement. It's.
What would you call the document?
I'm going to see if I can locate it. I think what you have to call it is a form that this particular realtor requires in order for you to list the property using them as a broker. It's not signed, okay? It's attached to Ms. Troutman's declaration. You know, listing agreements are signed, and they say that you're the agent. They go through and list all of the agency disclosures. You know, the various realty companies have their own form that they use with all those agency disclosures, and then it's signed by the client. This is not signed. It doesn't have those agency disclosures. It's entitled Listing Transaction Cover Sheet. Now, both Mr. Stepness and Ms. Troutman worked at Bridge Realty, as that's where they had their license held. So they had to do this in order to get the property listed on the MLS through Bridge Realty. That's all this form really comes down to, in my opinion. But again, we didn't litigate whether this constituted a write-in or not a write-in.
So do you think that does constitute a write-in then? Why is it? Well, let me ask this. Why isn't it a write-in?
I think it is. I can see the contrary argument, which it's not signed.
So does that satisfy 8285?
You know, I'd have to...
Does it apply?
I don't know that it does. I don't know that it does. And I'd have to do some studying of the statute to satisfy myself one way or the other.
What was your argument below on that issue?
We did not argue that was a writing that had anything to do with the statute. My argument below was Mr. Stepness made an equitable claim. He was not claiming that there was a listing agreement telling him he's going to get 7% or whatever percent commission he was going to earn. So when we got the claim, his claim, you read it, it tells you, I worked 8 months, I deserve to be paid. That's paraphrasing, of course, his claim, but that's essentially what he told the district court. I deserve to get something. That's what he told the district court.
Okay. Can you turn to the bankruptcy issue?
Certainly. Was there a particular question, Your Honor?
No. Okay. I'd like to hear your response to appellant's arguments as to why.
The one other point I want to make, counsel directed your attention to page 19 of her brief, and she cites there the Metro Building Company's case for the proposition that lack of standing is an affirmative defense raising capacity to sue. Again, we're conflating legal concepts. That's not what the Metro case states. And I'm quoting from the Court of Appeals decision. Ram argues that because the named corporate plaintiff, Metro Building Companies, Inc., does not exist, it is not an artificial person, and it lacks standing and capacity to sue. The court cites Cochran. Capacity to sue concerns a party's right to maintain any action, quoting Cochran. Ram further argues that the district court therefore lacked jurisdiction over Metro's case and that the lawsuit was a nullity, citing a Minnesota Supreme Court case, Annandale. Then the court goes on to say, Ram's claim that Metro lacks standing and capacity to sue is based on Ram's contention that Metro's lawsuit was commenced by a non-existent corporate entity. This argument lacks merit. Metro is a real corporation with a registered corporate name of Metro Building and Painting Companies. So they just had the wrong name and then argued lack of capacity to sue. And the court said, well, we're not buying that. It went on to say, we are not willing to equate this error with a conclusion that the lawsuit is a nullity because it was filed by a non-existent entity. Again, we're talking about standing. A party that has the right to bring the suit, that's standing. Capacity to sue is whether that party has capacity to bring any lawsuit. That's not what's at issue here. And again, the Scott case is right on point. It says right in its holding, the district court concluded that the defamation claims of appellant arise out of or are sufficiently rooted in his ownership of various rental property, which he owned prior to the bankruptcy petition. The district court determined, therefore, that those claims were part of the bankruptcy estate, and appellant lacks standing to pursue an action in state court. We agree with the district court's categorization of appellant's claims.
So
there it is.
So, counsel, looking at the record in the light most favorable to appellant, what is there that supports your argument that the bankruptcy court, the bankruptcy trustee, I'm sorry, had the is the right party here versus appellant?
His claim was rooted in his bankruptcy past. That's the measure. That's the standard. So this property was listed with him at a 0% commission, Beth Troutman at a 0% commission. Then it was taken off. The price was dropped. They relisted it, did it again. That's what his claim relates to. His claim relates to that work. And he says as much in his conciliation court complaint. He says, for 8 months, I did this work. I deserve to be paid.
Is there anything distinguishing post versus pre, any specific work?
I can't tell you that there is, because I there's nothing in the record. And if you look at, I also cited to the court the Parsons case, which is a case on a bankruptcy appeal involving real estate commissions. Mr. Stepniss' claim was indivisible. It's an equitable claim. You can't parse it into pieces. Counsel told you that he was entitled to a commission under the law. So if you look at page 27 of appellant's brief, the legal standard for a commission is cited. The legal standard, what you're entitled to lawfully as a commission. He was making an equitable claim. That Parsons case, Missouri uses the same standard for paying a commission to a real estate salesperson, basically being the procuring cause of the sale.
So he, because it's an equitable claim versus a legal claim, you're saying that there's a difference because the 7 months of work that he did pre-bankruptcy filing, that claim supports the bankruptcy trustee being the proper party here.
Precisely.
Why does that control, though, when there wasn't even any buyer at that time?
Because he is asking to be compensated for his services. It's not a commission. Again, we're conflating terms here. She uses the term commission. It's not a commission. You cannot call this a commission. If it's a commission, you got to satisfy the statute. You've got to have a percentage. You've got to have those terms specified in a writing. And again, I think it has to be a writing that's signed by the owner of the property, which this wasn't. I see my time is out. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, 5 minutes.
Your Honor, Judge Bryan, I said that I would come back to the issue of evidence in the record by plaintiff appellant as to work post petition. I would cite to the court the district court's finding that he did, in fact, do 7 months of work, or excuse me, I'm not going to quote the amount of time, but he did work post-petition. And I will note that if the defendants, respondents, objected to that finding, that that was their obligation to raise it here. So that is a finding of fact that is law of the case that this court
must... What page are you referring to?
In terms of the district court judge's decision, is that what
Correct.
You meant? It is, I believe, on page 10. Let's see. Maybe earlier. I am referring to parts of the judge's order on page 9, A33. I don't want to take up too much time here. If it's possible the judge was just discussing plaintiff's claim as opposed to making a finding, I will leave it up to you.
Where on page 833 are you referring? What was the finding that you're pointing to?
I guess all I can see this quickly, and again, I would urge you guys to look further, excuse me, you judges to look further. It says that it discusses that the property was relisted on the 8th and sold there. Thus, the judge there, I see, says even if plaintiff did some marketing work, the majority of the work predated his bankruptcy. So in reviewing the facts most favorably to the plaintiff, the court was taking that assumption that some of the work was done post-petition.
But that, at the same time, there's work, the majority of the work, 7 out of the 8 months, was done pre-petition.
Right.
And that's what his claim is based on, is, hey, I did this work, I should be compensated for the work that I did.
Correct, but there are times when plaintiffs make allegations about the amount of damages they're entitled to, or and at most what that impacts is a decision at the on the merits that he's not entitled to anything for the months pre-petition. He's only entitled to post-petition. It doesn't exclude his claim altogether because he said 8 months in his original statement of the claim, and the law ends up in the end saying you're only entitled to 7 months worth of work. So it doesn't...
Is there any implication to what the court puts in the background section? It doesn't have a finding section in its opinion, but it does have a background section. And it says, also relevant to plaintiff's claims herein, is that he filed for bankruptcy on February 2nd without disclosing that he had a contingent interest in the anticipated sale of the property. Is there any implication to the fact that he doesn't disclose that? I mean, what you're saying now is that he had this claim built up over the previous 7 months.
No, in fact, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying this pro se defendant, or excuse me, plaintiff, made a mistake when he said 8 months of his statement of claim, and legally he is not required to that. Legally, he does not have a capacity to sue for the amount that is pre-petition. It does not mean he does not have capacity to sue for the post-petition. And indeed... since there was no, listing.
Let me phrase it differently. The amount that he was requesting includes compensation for services prior to February 2nd. Okay, so that's what I'm saying. If there's some portion of what he's requesting that is related to pre-bankruptcy filing, then isn't that something he should have disclosed when he filed bankruptcy?
The fact of the matter is, this is after the bankruptcy estate has closed. And if you note, there are some cases cited that that once the bankruptcy estate is closed and the defendant is raising post-petition items, that claim lies in the plaintiff having capacity to sue in the district court. He is not able to go back to the bankruptcy court to get paid on this matter. And so while he may have made an error in seeking compensation of $15,000 for the entire 8 months, that does not mean he did not have capacity to sue on the amount of time that was post-petition. And the whole issue of whether there is capacity to sue is not correctly decided because there's no reference to Minnesota law, no application of Minnesota law on whether he had any property interest on February 2nd and therefore whether that property interest went to the bankruptcy estate. And I say the facts are there's no genuine issue of material fact that even suggests that he had a property interest that date, and therefore the bankruptcy court trustee had any interest. And so he's not doing anything wrong and has the capacity to sue when he files his claim later. At the minimum, these are genuine issues of material fact. That is what I would suggest, and I hope the court looks at this with the fairness that it must look to the pro se claimant as one with liberality, who deserves liberality in his pleadings. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both, counsels. Very well argued. We appreciate that. We will be issuing an opinion within the statutory time frame. Thank you both.